morning. Let's let's continue.
Two of them are downstairs.
We're going to next year have this in the cafe, and then it'll be all that much easier. We won't have to tape it either. But we're going to continue with the Diamond NV system. And you know, remember, it's a nice microscopic system. And so we're looking at one atomic defect, and it has all that going for it. Of course, we're still going to be looking at ensembles, because in order to measure it, we're going to need to have lots of statistics. But we'll see how that plays out. And so we have our diamond. And in the diamond, there's a nitrogen in the vacancy. And this center looks as though it has two electrons that undergo an exchange interaction. And the electrons, if I look at their magnetic moments, their response to the magnetic field, they look like they're free electrons. So these are so-called G equal 2 electrons. So G is just another number that's telling us the same thing as the Girard magnetic ratio. And so it's nearly G equal 2. So they're nearly free. They're spread about. But they're indistinguishable in this. And for the most part, we're going to think about a diamond, and we're going to imagine our defect is below the surface of the diamond. And the reason for that is, of course, a diamond is a three-dimensional structure. So if I truncate it with a surface, then there has to be something not nice happening at the surface. There's a bunch of bonds that, of course, can't continue. And so they need to be truncated somehow. And that always ends up giving us a bunch of dirt. And so there is some chemical magic to get your surface clean enough magnetically that you can move the defect close to the surface. And of course, for some applications, if you're using this for a sensor, you really do want it to get close to the surface. But for now, we're going to ignore those complications just by saying we're looking deeper into the material. Okay, and then because we have the strong exchange interaction, what happens is we end up falling into the triplet singlet domain. And so we have two eigenstates that have the same energy. And then the two spin states with the other symmetry. And to the extent that the spins truly are indistinguishable, then we're in this this block subdiagonal representation of the Hilbert space, and there's no interactions between these. So you're either stuck in this space or you're stuck over here in this space, and there's no way of getting between them. And so when we look at the triplet space, then we typically relabel that in terms of the magnetic quantum numbers of the eigenstates. Okay. Now we saw that since we're in the solid state, this strict separation isn't going to be followed. But that only shows up for us when we're in the electronically excited state. And for the functionality of our experiments, it's enough that we just keep this much of the structure. And so we have still the magnetic quantum numbers, we have over here an inner system crossing, and effectively it's going to end up polarizing the zero state. It won't do that directly, but since we're only concerned with what happens here, all of our control is here, then it won't matter to us what happens there. And we saw that that's nicely these recycling transitions, so that if I started off in the zero state, I would return to the zero state, and so we would cycle. And the lifetime here is 20 nanoseconds. The lifetime here is 300 nanoseconds. And this is dark in our experiment. And I should have said that's 1/3 of the time. Okay. And so we can shine light and end up only in the zero state. So that's good, we can polarize. Doesn't take that long to do it. You know, 600 nanoseconds, you're very well in that state. You're shining a pretty bright laser, so the rate that you go up in the electronic is quite fast. And then 20 nanoseconds down, regardless of the manifold. And you need 600 nanoseconds because you don't want to be hanging out here. You want to have fallen down into the ground state. We can use the confocal system we saw because I can excite in the green above this transition, and it'll fall down. And of course, it'll still conserve the magnetic quantum numbers. And so that makes it easy. And the confocal piece is great, but remember that you have one defect there. So we showed with the Hanbury-Brown twist experiment that we could tell whether we had one defect or not, but we have one defect. And that defect is going to emit into all solid angles. And so the probability that that photon reaches our detector, if it reaches the detector, we'll detect it. But the probability that it reaches the detector is something like 1%. And so what we're going to need to do is to count, is to repeat many experiments, but also to count for a long time. And so we saw that if I looked at the statistics here, if I was in the ground state, and let's just put number of detected photons versus time, if I was in the MS equals zero state, there's some rate. The MS equals one state, one plus or minus one, starts off with a rate of 2/3 of the zero state, but of course then eventually everything is in zero and you return to that rate. And so in order to have a contrast between those two, or contrast to noise, we need to count for a short period of time. And so if I was counting for 300 nanoseconds, then remember that it only falls down at 20 nanoseconds. So it's only emitted some 10 or tens of photons, and only 1% of those have hit my detector, so your detector hasn't clicked yet. Right? So, you know, often we think that, oh, by going to a microscopic system, we're getting a system where we don't have to average. You know, that's not true two ways. One, you know, you have to look at all the efficiencies. And two, of course, you also have to think about what your answer is. You know, that generally we're looking for an expectation value.
Okay.
Now, it's also important to note that here we're getting out counts regardless of what the state is, right? So effectively we're binning, we're saying that if I did many, many averages and I looked at the probability of a number of photons versus the number of, let's call it counts, and that if I was in the zero state, that probability should be somewhere here. And if I was in the one state, it should be somewhere here. And of course, what we would like is that there was no overlap in these. And what we're going to do is we're going to say, oh, I run the experiment, and if I find I'm here, then I say, oh, it's one. And if I find I'm here, I say it's zero. And in this particular case, if I found myself here, you'd throw it away. If you're doing Bayesian analysis, you wouldn't throw it away, right? Depends on what your analysis is. And the experimentally, what we need to do is we measure the average intensity for MS equals zero and for MS equals plus or minus one. And we do that continually over the experiment. So we do it interleaved with the experiment, so we always have a reference of what these are. So the experiment costs us a little bit more time. And you say, well, why should these things change? Remember that we have one defect, but we have a spot that is about a micron in size. And so when I align the spot to the defect, all I know is it's in that spot size. And of course, we're going to need to actively keep the spot at the same place. And so what will happen is our defect, from the point of view of the spot, will meander around, just as humidity, temperature, the moon rises, and other things. And the efficiency isn't really quite the same everywhere. And so occasionally, of course, we move it and put it back to what we think is the best. All right. Good. So now then, we go and say, let's have a look at spin physics. So we have a Hamiltonian for the NV that is just describing that splitting of the exchange interaction, which is called the zero field splitting, because it happens in zero field. And so we'll write this down in terms of the spin operators for spin one, instead of the Pauli operators for the two spin 1/2 particles. Because again, we're living and controlling just in this basis. Okay. Good. Now that I want to apply a microwave field. So this is 3 gigahertz, which is a convenient frequency to work with. You know, your microwave oven operates at 2.5 gigahertz. And so we apply microwave radiation. And when I applied microwave radiation In the spin case before, I used a rotating field. I'm not going to do that today. Here I use an alternating field. That's what SX looks like in spin one. And the reason is that we're driving two different transitions. We're driving the 0 to plus 1 transition, and we're driving the 0 to minus 1 transition. And so I can take each of those transitions, and I can treat them as though they were a fictitious spin 1 half particle. And if we did that, what you would find is that the fictitious spin 1 half particle of the 0 to plus 1 coherence, so sigma x in that two-level system, would evolve in a right-handed way. And the 0 to minus 1 would evolve in the opposite direction. So if I take this oscillating field, remember we can take an oscillating field and I can decompose this into a rotating field e to the I omega t t over 2 sigma z, and a field rotating in the opposite direction and this one is going to drive the 0 to plus 1 and this is going to drive 0 to minus 1. And normally, in the rotating wave approximation, we would, of course, only keep one of these. But now we need this structure, in fact, to drive both transitions. Or if I only wanted to drive one of those transitions, I could apply a circularly polarized field and drive selectively those two. Okay, but usually we do this. Okay. Now we need to do one more thing. We've got our diamond. And the diamond is a crystal. And we know the orientation of the diamond. So, you know, it's a 100 or a 111 diamond. And depending upon the orientation of the diamond, then the orientation of the carbon atoms in the diamond will be fixed. But the orientation of the principal axis system of the NV is along the direction, the bond between the nitrogen and the vacancy. So it's along that axis. So the principal axis system, of course, is the axis system in which that interaction is diagonal. And so our z direction depends upon which orientation of these four the NV actually has. So we have to find, take this one for instance, because it's nice. And then we would say that z is in that direction, because z is not defined by anything internal. Z is defined by the internal chemistry of the system in the exchange interaction. So by looking at your experimental setup, you have no right to say the z-axis is in this particular direction, as opposed to the spin case where we applied a magnetic field and the z-axis was along the magnetic field. Now, of course, for the microwaves, what I want is I want the microwaves to be perpendicular to z. It's not a big deal because, of course, if it's not perpendicular, it's only the component perpendicular that's going to drive the system, right? But you know, if it's accidentally aligned with the z-axis, then you're bloody out of luck. All right. So let's look at an experiment. So the Ravi drive is a nice experiment to start off with. And in the experiment that we want to run, the first thing we need to do is to turn the laser on and polarize so that after we've turned the laser on for some time, we fall into the zero state. And so at this point here, I can say, oh yes, I'm at MS is equal to zero. And it's worth me saying that the precision of that is about 0.95 if I was looking at the probability that I'm in that state. Okay, so it's good, not great. Then we have the microwave field. So we want to turn off the laser. And I want to live in that ground manifold while I'm doing my experiment. Remember that all of the frequencies for the spins in the excited manifold are different, and we fall down randomly in time. So if I sample the excited state, that's just going to look like a T2 process. So we turn on the microwave for some time, which we would increment. And then I want to detect. And so when I detect, I need to turn back on the laser so that I have the cycling transition. And I need to turn on the detector for some short period. So I can count. And then I need to repeat this 15,000 times or so. And then I can choose another value of T1 and repeat it. It's not so bad, right? Because, you know, this long time here is all of 600 nanoseconds. So, you know, we can still go through this quickly. But this is what the experiment to do with Ravi would look like. Good. And it's worth thinking about the dynamics in spin one space, if you haven't seen it. So, you know, remember first that that when you're looking at dynamics of spin one half systems, it's all very nice because the Pauli operators are square to the identity. In any other spin system, that's not true. You know, clearly, these operators don't square to the identity. And but still, it's easy to exponentiate and see. And of course, what happens is if I start off in the zero state, and the two am at zero magnetic field, so the two excited states are indistinguishable, then I'm going to be creating a coherence as I go into the excited state. Okay, so have a look and see. Good. So now, most experiments aren't at zero field. And so if I take the Hamiltonian and I keep the zero field splitting, then I can add a term that is just dependent upon SC. And so I'll get splitting of those two. And the splitting is a bit more than 10 megahertz per Gauss for a free electron. Okay. Now before we go and look too much at this, we need to remember that the NV defect, the N is nitrogen. And nitrogen has two isotopes, nitrogen 14 and nitrogen 15. Nitrogen 15 is spin 1/2, but it's extremely rare. It's 0.2% or something. And so everything that we see is nitrogen 14, which is also a spin 1. So now then, so now we can talk about the Hamiltonian of the nitrogen 14. And since it's spin 1, right, that the fact that the spin is not 1/2 tells you that the electronic structure in the nucleus is not symmetrical. Right? That's what spin 1/2 says, that the nuclear structure is spherically symmetric. And if it's not spherically symmetric, then of course it can couple to charges that are outside of the nucleus. And so what happens is we get a quadrupole splitting of this. So it's going to look like IZ squared, the quadrupole frequency, and this is 5 megahertz. And okay, IZ, still spin 1, so I'm going to use I for nuclear spins and S for electron spins. 5 megahertz. This piece is actually easy to calculate. That what you do is you look at the charge distribution around the atom, and you just calculate the electric field gradient. And then the overlap of the electric field gradient with the nucleus gives you the amplitude of the quadrupole coupling. And so if the atom was in a lattice, had cubic symmetry, then that would be 0. And you can just put charges, back of the envelope calculation will be correct. Okay, so we have 5 megahertz here, but now this axis is the z-axis of the quadrupolar interaction, which is given by the structure of the electric field gradient in your system. Fortunately, the electric field gradient is going to be tied to the same defect structure that the nv-axis is. And so both of the principal axis systems for the NV and for the quadrupole are fixed to the crystal structure. And in this case, they're both aligned. So here, the Z direction is also the NV direction. So it all becomes easy. Okay. Now, this is what you would see if you had a bare nitrogen. And so, for instance, if we were looking at detecting explosives that are rich in nitrogen, we can use nuclear quadrupole resonance to see those. It's one of the ways that we detect landmines. But if I take this and I add it to the NV Hamiltonian, so we still have the zero field splitting of the NV. We still have the Zeeman interaction of that electron. We have the quadrupole interaction called a Q. And we have the nuclear Zeeman interaction of the nitrogen spin, plus we have 2 hyperfine terms. Okay, so that's the Hamiltonian that we have so far. Now this piece, we can throw away. It's non-secular. So non-secular says that it doesn't commute with the quantizing interaction of our system. And for the quantizing interaction, we just take the biggest term in the Hamiltonian, and this is the biggest term at 3 gigahertz. And clearly, it doesn't commute. The other way you could say is that it's, of course, not time independent, which is the same thing saying it doesn't commute, or you can say it doesn't shift the energy spectrum of the eigenstates of the quantizing Hamiltonian, which is, again, it's the same statement. Okay, this piece here is about 2.5 megahertz. And it's useful, we're going to come back and talk about where that comes from. This, as I said, is, I've lost it, 5 megahertz. And these pieces, gamma electron over gamma nitrogen, is about 10 to the 4. And so if I was thinking about out of all of this piece, what do I need to keep for the effective Hamiltonian? Well, clearly we need to keep this piece. And we're going to keep this piece, even though it might be small, it's actually going to give us a shift between the plus minus 1 energy levels. So anything that's going to shift the energy of states that we're creating coherences between, we better keep. And so we'll keep this even though it is going to be small. Since we observe the electron spin, there's no reason to keep the quantization axis of the nuclear spin. We're not going to see that. There's no reason to keep this. That's, of course, non-secular, but we do need to keep that term as well. And the hyperfine interaction has two pieces to it. So it has a Fermi contact term and a dipolar term. The dipolar term is the easiest. If I have two magnets, then they interact through space. Your refrigerator magnets do the same thing. The Fermi contact term says that if I have an electron wave function that overlaps the nuclear spin, okay, so it overlaps the origin of an atom, so it overlaps the nucleus, then it will couple magnetically. And so we'll see an interaction which looks like sigma dot sigma, if we're talking about 2.5 particles, provided the electron can overlap the nucleus. And the only orbitals that overlap the nucleus are S orbitals, right? Everything else is a node at the origin. So the Fermi contact term says that provided the bonding structure has an S character, then we can have a direct overlap of the electron spin and the nuclear spin. And that's what gives us this energy splitting here. Now, when Ray was talking to you about the scalar coupling in liquid state NMR, that comes from exactly the same interaction, that you have two nuclear spins, and there needs to be an electron that shares a molecular orbital with both of those, and it needs to have S character at both of those. And that's why, one, the scalar coupling is only for nearly, it doesn't go out many bonds. And that's also why it's so small, right? The scalar coupling is only of the order hertz, because it has to have two electron nuclear interactions, and they're both not large. Okay, so now we have our nitrogen spin sitting there. We want to characterize that. And so the experiment that we do is to turn on the laser. To turn on the detector. But I'm going to count in small Okay, so I've turned on the detector, but I'm going to bin it every 600 nanoseconds. I'm going to turn on the microwave field. And I'm going to take the microwave frequency. I'm going to sweep that. So in order to see what we're doing, let's write down the energy level diagrams of these. So we have ms equals 0, minus 1, plus 1. This separation is the zero field splitting. I'll give us some separation for a magnetic field. So we'll assume that there's a magnetic field on, and that is gamma electron B naught. Now then we're going to add this hyperfine term, okay? But remember that the hyperfine term is going to coupler angular momentum. So when SZ is equal to 0, it doesn't matter what IZ is, right? So we end up having three states here that are degenerate for the nitrogen quantum numbers there. Now, of course, we also get three states for each of these. And of course, the zero states don't shift for exactly the same reason, right? But the order is inverted. In these, right? Because we're looking at the product of two spin one spaces. And now we can ask, well, what are allowed transitions? And we're driving the system with just this SX operator. And we threw away this nice piece here. Everything else is simply quantized. So the only transitions that are allowed under that picture are those that change the electron quantum number by plus or minus 1. Right, so the dipole allowed for electron. So minus 1 connects to minus 1. 0 connects to 0. And 1 connects to 1. So now let's go back over here and see what happens. We turned on the laser. So, and we're going to assume that we start with the frequency so far away that nothing can happen. It can't drive any transitions. And so there we end up in the zero state, right? And we're detecting, and so we're detecting at the start up here at our MS equals 0 level. And we're sweeping the microwave frequency. And we have MS equal 1 down here, plus or minus 1. And I should have said, even though we create an energy difference between these two, for the electronic states, the electronic energies are so much higher that it makes no bloody difference for the experiments we're doing with the detection efficiency. So if we're in plus 1 or minus 1, even though there's an energy splitting, it makes no difference. Now at some point, we come on resonance with one of the transitions. You know, whichever one is the longest line in our diagram, right? That's the lowest energy transition. And what's going to happen then, of course, is that the system can be excited to the plus 1 state. And so it's going to decrease in amplitude, and it will do this three times, and then three times again, and it'll do this for one, zero, minus one, and then, you know, the one is the highest energy. And this separation here is the separation between the Zeeman split lines of the electron spin. Okay? So we just go through and do this. Now, it's worthwhile to remember that the T1 of the nitrogen is long. And so imagine that the nitrogen is sitting there. And we don't change the nitrogen state. So if I could detect all the photons and I went through, what I would find is that I would get two lines, right? Those two, or those two, or those two. Because the nitrogen is fixed in its eigenstructure. It's going to have that eigenstructure for a whole second. And of course, these dips would come all the way down to zero, all the way down to the MS plus minus one line. But since we repeat this over and over again, that it's only going to be in that plus one state one third of the time. The other two thirds of the time, just randomly, it's going to be in one of those other two states. And so we don't get all the way down as we count to the MS equals plus minus one transition. Yeah? Okay. Good. Now,
when you're measuring them experimentally, you use the same thing you did up there with the, your two different gradient lines at the top.
Yes, that's exactly right. So what we do is we go through and set these two lines. Now, this process, usually what we're looking at is just, do we see the dips? Do they have the right line width? Are they in the right places? So then we're not being very careful about saying, it's not like we're measuring where we want to know the fidelity of a gauge or something. And then it's not important that we keep going back and measuring these. They don't change that quickly. We can just go ahead and scan. But if you wanted to be careful about it, then you would keep coming back and you would interleave with a measurement of the zero and one state. Yeah? Good. Okay. Now I want to one last piece today. This, of course, would allow us to have other controls in the system, this non-secular term. And controlling the nitrogen directly, these frequencies are really small. This frequency is about 10 kilohertz. And so if I wanted to control the nitrogen, just like it was in an NMR experiment, by applying a frequency. Well, the frequency I need to apply is 10 kilohertz. And it would just take too long to have any control. There's nothing interesting that's going to happen. So what we want to do is we want to find a way of getting control where I don't have to address the nuclear spins directly. I want all the control to come through the electron. So we're going to use the electron spin to control the nuclear spins. And so I want to show you some physics, which at the moment I'm not going to connect to this, and then tomorrow I'll connect it. So we have the hyperfine interaction, which we said was our Fermi contact plus the dipolar. And the Fermi contact is going to be this I dot S piece. And let's, for the moment, think about spin 1/2 nuclei and spin 1/2 electrons, just to keep our Hilbert space a little bit smaller. And then the dipolar piece of the interaction is going to have this term that you know from classical dipolar energies. Okay? And I'm going to expand this and then keep only the interesting terms that are secular. And in doing that, I'm going to assume that the only energy that matters is the electron Zeeman energy. I'm going to make the electron quantization be the strongest thing. And you'll find that done in lots of books, and it's a couple pages, and I don't like having to write out on the board trivial algebra, so I'm not going to write it out for you, except to give you the last answer. Now, I could have included an IYSZ term, but it doesn't add anything to the physics because I have an IZSZ term here. So now this is what's quantized us. So that's defined our quantization axis. That means that the electron spin state is a good quantum number. So as you look at the Hamiltonian, you want to think about looking at the Hamiltonian for the electron spin up and the electron spin down. There are two good quantum numbers. One quantum number with two values. And now then, you have this lovely piece of saying, we'll take the Hamiltonian for the nucleus, and I'll do it effectively for the spin up. So I'm going to just take SZ and put in plus 1/2. And I only want to keep the terms that depend upon the nuclear spin. And I can do the same thing for the nuclear spin being down. Or the electron spin being down, sorry. And if I'm clever, I make these two terms of order one. And now you look at those two Hamiltonians, and you can see that depending upon which electron manifold we're in, the nuclear spin is quantized in a different direction. And so I can have the nuclear spin having its Zeeman interaction, the hyperfine interaction along the two directions, and we get some quantization axis this way, or this could be negative, and that could be negative, and we get our quantization axis over there. And of course, if I give you two different quantization axis for a spin 1/2 particle and allow you to switch between those, then you have universal control. Right? By jumping back and forth between those, you can go and you can rotate the block sphere any way you like. It's not the most clever way of doing it, but it works. If you rotate the electron continuously, which is the most clever way of doing it, it works yet more efficiently, which is how we do it. So this gives us universal control over the nuclear spin. But I never have to address the nuclear spin directly. That all of the control that I'll implement to rotate the nuclear spin, I'm going to do by rotating the electron spin. And since I can rotate the electron spin state in a couple of nanoseconds, I can go from having a control which was only the nuclear spin that had a rate of 10 kilohertz at best, to having control of the nuclear spin that has a rate of hundreds of megahertz. And so we use the electron spin as an actuator to control the nuclear spin, knowing that the nuclear spin is going to be able to store quantum information for much longer. Okay, then what I want to show you tomorrow is how we extend that to have more control than just one individual NV center. Okay? Questions?
I saw a talk on something similar to this recently.
What was that?
I saw a talk on something similar to this recently, and their issue with indirect control was that if you don't time it exactly right, your nucleus and your electron will become entangled, and therefore you're encoding a mixed state into the nitrogen nucleus.
Well, you must have been talking with a really poor experimentalist.
It's because of theory, so.
Well, then they're by definition a poor experimentalist. Come on.
So there's
no problem. So I mean, we've benchmarked these things, and the control of this is exquisite. There are lots of places where one can have problems, but this isn't one of them. And yes, if you want to do quantum computing, you're burdened to do things well. But you know, what you're really burdened to do is you're burdened to make pulses that are robust to what you can't control or what you don't know. And so if you look at our papers, what you would find is a landscape plot that would have something that says, oh, well, in this case, you know, it would have omega A and omega B. Maybe one of those would be a Rabi frequency. And then we would show you over what range we would have what fidelity. And so we arrange what look like very complicated pulses, so that provided you're within some good range of the values, they give you the fidelity that you want. And that is, those methods we've worked out really quite well. And we can find those pulses and implement them very effectively. So it is a requirement that one think about what you don't know as you're building your experiment, and make sure that your experiment accommodates that. And you know, you might think, oh, you know, doesn't this violate linearity or something? But no, of course not. That I can have a complex operation which appears to be exactly the same unitary for a wide range of parameters. Yeah. So there's nothing that's violating. The fact that your unitary is the same for a range of parameters doesn't violate linearity. It's only if you have two states that you're mapping to the same state. Yeah? But I'd be happy to talk more. Thanks.